Hey, welcome to the Digital Communicator Forecast. I'm Hemming Nelson.
And I'm Brian Kessler.
And today's guest is Scott Kratz, who's the director of the 11th Street Bridge Park. And he's done some amazing things, most of which involve starting an organization from just an idea that was a pretty big idea and taking it on through to fruition almost. He's well on his way to building a bridge over the Anacostia River. So we're going to talk to him about what it takes to start a nonprofit and how do you maintain the enthusiasm and strategically what do you think about when you're building your organization.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have Scott. It's such an ambitious plan. For anybody who's familiar with what's going on here in D.C., I think you're really going to enjoy our conversation with Scott.
Yeah, and instead of beers today, we had tacos, and the tacos were sponsored by
Charity Engine. I can't say if your tacos are driving you to drink. If your CRM is driving you to drink, give Charity Engine a call.
If your CRM is driving you to eat tacos. Mexican food. Give Charity Engine a call. And here's our talk with Scott. Yeah, so what brought you to D.C.? Let's start there.
And be engaging.
Yeah.
Don't be boring. What brought me to D.C.?
Usually we try not to do the cold open like that.
My background is in museum education. So I've worked in museums the last 20 years. And what brought me to D.C. was the job as the Vice President of Education at the National Building Museum.
And you were there for, you said, 7 or 8 years?
There for 7 or 8 years, yeah.
And what was your job there mainly?
I was the vice president of education. So I led a staff of about a dozen full-time and then another 12 or 15 sort of part-time staff that did all of the academic lectures, programs, school programs, big family festivals, and the like.
And that's distinct from, like, the collections department or anybody who's putting together any of the exhibitions that show up there, things like that.
Yeah, we would work with those staff. We'd work with those curators to think about what that visitor experience was, to go through the exhibitions. Yeah. But it was more about when people come to the museum for a school program or for a lecture or for a big family event.
It's kind of, you know, I could just imagine somebody walking down the street with their headphones on listening to this and then, jumping about a foot when they hear a giant dog bark.
Almost like we did, but not really anticipating it. At least we were prepared because we knew the dogs were here.
Yeah, what were we talking
about? What was my job there? So my job at the Building Museum was to lead a team created the experiences where people came into the museum, whether it was a school program or whether it was a big family festival or whether it was
Is that kind of a new lecture. Thing in sort of the philosophy of how you run a museum, which is, you know, before it's just a museum, you go, there's a piece of art on the wall, there's a placard next to it that tells you why it's important. Is that evolved over the past quarter century?
The museum education's actually been around for about 40 years, 45 years. Become more central, I think, to a mission of most museums. Well, I think before museums were about collecting and displaying, now they're about collecting, displaying, and educating. And that's the role of a museum educator.
And how does that change in the digital age? You came on board, right, I guess, probably when a lot of that technology was being adapted.
Yeah, and it was fairly controversial within the museum world. I think, traditionalist that said we can't digitize things and put things online because that will mean that the people won't come to see our stuff. And there were lots of other people, myself included, saying, no, that's not going to be the case. This is going to be the thing that is going to want, that will be an entry point to have them see the authentic object. And that's truly how things have worked.
It's that authenticity. Worked with folks, same thing. You know, they're very afraid to put their digital assets online. I mean, you see this in the movie industry and any really production right now. There's been this hesitancy to put it out there, but what everybody realizes is once you give a little bit, it actually gains interest. And if there is something authentic, people will come. Whether if you're a musician, they're going to go to the concert, or you've got the Mona Lisa on display. You know, seeing a high quality JPEG is no substitute for catching a glimpse in person.
You know, seeing a Rothko on your iPhone is going to be a completely different experience than coming and seeing that Rothko at the National Gallery of Art, yeah. Right? And so one can lead to the other, and it is a that transitional experience. So, and then also, I think more and more, I mean, we were in Washington, D.C., which is great, but if you lived in California, or you lived in Alaska, or you're in Russia, you're not going to have the opportunity to come there. So we, working with you, we really worked on how do we make sure we're capturing that experience and posting it online as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. And you found a pretty good reception to that. I mean, I know that you guys underwent a really big website redesign project and capturing things on video, making your public programs available online in video format. Spent a lot of effort and man hours doing that. Was that worth it? Did you learn anything?
I think we learned a ton. Our director of communications and marketing really led that effort, Brenna Lipper. But I think one of my big takeaways is that it's don't just duplicate what the experience is in person, but how do you think about what that channel is that might be different that could lend itself to a different experience? And so a great example of that is instead of I mean, no one's going to sit down and watch, or very few people are going to sit down and watch an hour and a half lecture, right? That's just not the online experience. But while we have people, while we have these amazing architects and landscape architects and designers in town, let's interview them and winnow that down to a 2-3-4 minute soundbite, right? And that's something I think that people engage with. Mm-hmm. Or we led a series of new videos called Great Green Places that I think are probably still on the interwebs somewhere. But that had architects and landscape architects decode signature civic spaces where we went there on site working mm-hmm. sort of with you and helping us direct it that were really successful.
Yeah, the thing that I think I was most surprised about when I started working with the Building Museum was, you know, I would expect that the Building Museum would be pictures of buildings and maybe a focus on architecture and design. But what I think what you guys probably spent the most time on, at least from what I could tell, is more about the communal aspect of what a building is and how a community is formed around it and whether it's sustainable and all that kind of stuff. And it's more about creating the space that people live in and how that impacts the quality of life. So sort of expanding that definition of how buildings, you know, how we interact with buildings, which leads us to why you're here today, which because you're actually building a bridge over
indeed.
A river.
A literal bridge.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, what are you doing exactly?
We are – so I work for a nonprofit, appropriately enough, called Building Bridges Across the River at the Arc. It's located east of the river, and we are partnering with city agencies to transform an old freeway bridge into a park physically over the river to create this physical and metaphorical bridge between long-divided communities.
And you just woke up one day and thought – geez, I wish I could walk to Anacostia this morning.
I woke up and said, gee, I want to build a bridge. No, I had no intention of, I had no idea when I first moved to D.C. 10 years ago that I'd be building a bridge. That wasn't part of the career path that I'd laid out for myself, working in museums for 20-some-odd years. But it was in that capacity working at the Building Museum, I got to know Harriet Tregoning, who then was mm-hmm. the D.C. Office of Planning Director. And we were having breakfast bright and early one morning, and I asked what I thought was a totally innocent question at the time. Beware.
So anything I can do to help you out?
How
can I spend the next 10 years of my life?
Right, raising tens of millions of dollars and physically constructing a bridge. No, I asked the question of what's happening with all that construction on these bridges that are in my backyard, because this is my neighborhood. I'm at Barracks Row.
You live on Capitol Hill.
I'm by Barracks Row. And Harriet immediately sort of locked eyes and said, ooh, hey, I've got a project for you that you'd be perfect for, and explained what the whole goals were and this unique once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and asked if I could volunteer. And
How did this come onto her radar? No.
I think Harriet's always been this incredible visionary and I think this was, keep in mind, this was 4.5-5 years ago. So the High Line hadn't quite opened yet, or if it had, it just barely opened, right? So this idea of transforming old aged out infrastructure into new civic spaces was starting to pop up around the country. Mm-hmm. And I think increasingly cities were recognizing that they are defined by their civic spaces, the places where people can rub elbows with people that otherwise they wouldn't normally cross paths with. So she saw this as an opportunity to say, hey, instead of getting rid of all this old infrastructure, can we build one of these, can we build a really unique civic space that works for not only tourists, but also the coming to DC, but more importantly, can stitch together these communities that are only 1,100 feet apart from each other on the river, but might as well be light years apart otherwise.
And you're talking about Anacostia, which is traditionally a much poorer neighborhood, different demographics than the folks up on Capitol Hill who are more upper income. And they're not, as you say, they're a quarter mile apart, but you probably never ventured over to Anacostia very often.
I had a few times, but yeah. But I asked
but maybe to use the green space on along the river, or to, you don't go shopping over there.
Went to the Frederick Douglass House, and that's over there. Or the Smithsonian Anacostia Community Museum, but to places that are not that highly trafficked. And to your point, I mean, I've asked my neighbor to stand on his porch and just point to where the river is. Right, I live 3.5 blocks away from the river, and he couldn't do it. Right, yeah. He couldn't point to where the river was, and if he had never been.
But
down
he could point to the Capitol, or
you can point to the Capitol building. You can point to the Washington Monument. You can point to the Marine Barracks. You can point to Easter Market. All these other sort of recognizable icons. And if he can't point to where the river is, there's a guarantee that you haven't actually been over the river then, right? So this was an opportunity to engage people not only with the river itself, but with the communities on both sides.
Was that one of the original impetuses for the project, if that's a word, impetuses?
What is the Latin plural of
I mean, Harriet, as the director of planning, she was thinking about revitalizing some aging infrastructure, or she was thinking about something that could be used to get the city together?
Yeah, yes. A little from column A and a little from column B. And a few, as well as engaging people with the river itself, right? And as we continued to sort of think about this, added two other goals. The public health is an enormous goal. The communities who live along the Anacostia River have some of the most challenging health statistics in the city, in the country, actually. And having an access to safe places to play can be a significant intervention to that. And if this park becomes a real destination, which we think it will, then that this can become an anchor for equitable and inclusive development as well. So those are the sort of four key goals.
Are there precedents for similar situations in the U.S.? I think maybe in Europe of a park on a bridge, but it almost seems impossible here in the U.S. to get something so community-focused passed.
So there are more and more. There's similar, nothing quite like this. This is sort of unique.
But it's very large.
It's about 3 acres. So it's about the size of 3 football fields stacked end to end to end. There's a great park called Clyde Warren Park in Dallas, where they decked over a freeway, where the free. So instead of a river, it was a freeway that divided two different neighborhoods. And they created what's called the Clyde Warren Park, which is a 3-4 acre park. It's been remarkably successful and helped connect a neighborhood, as I understand it, to the cultural sort of centers that had long been disconnected. There's other sort of transformed infrastructure into parks like the High Line in New York, or Shelby Street Bridge in Nashville, or the my favorite named bridge, the Purple People Mover Bridge in Cincinnati, that actually connects two different neighborhoods, two different states on the other side of the Ohio River. But most of those places are more paths and not places. It's a little bit of both, but this is going to be more of a place than it's going to be both place and path. We envision that this would be a destination.
So when you were originally approached to do this, did you have any idea what was involved?
No.
No.
No, I had no idea. That's probably why you got involved.
Yeah, ignorance is bliss. I had no idea that I'd be – I mean, I ended up volunteering.
But did you even know what the process was going to be by which a bridge gets built at that point?
Quick Google search.
I've read my David Macaulay books about bridges, so I could draw one, I suppose.
But, who's that guy, Moses, up in New York? He's the guy you'd want to he was the anti-park guy, though, more. He's the guy who paves over all the green spaces, right?
Well, they created a lot of parks, too, actually. But he also paved over a lot of spaces and divided neighborhoods, Robert Moses. I knew that we needed to start with a community, and that has become our real foundation, the DNA of the project. Mm-hmm. What the physical process of building a bridge and doing load testing on peers and talking about live load and dead load, and I mean, that was not sort of my skill set necessarily. And thankfully, we've got very bright engineers who are working on this project and designers.
That's what we really want to talk about today, is the difference between live load and dead load.
That's going to be a fascinating
most of
podcast,
our listeners
right?
want to hear.
Yeah, right. 45
minutes. If you broke it up into pieces, would it be fair to say there's the sort of the the community outreach sort of political effort of getting enough community support and letting politicians know about it. And
stakeholder engagement.
And stuff. And then there's the technical, like we got to get architects and we got to have someone who actually builds the bridge.
And then there's raising enough money
fundraising.
To... Right.
Is that sort of the three big job descriptions?
Yes, those are the three big buckets. Nicely done, Hemming.
Okay. I think I'm starting to understand. and how, I guess let's break it up into pieces. I think the community outreach is sort of what I'm most aware of you doing, because you're probably out on the road 2, 3, 4 nights a week talking to groups of citizens, traveling to other cities. What's that involved?
Well, for the first 2 years, it was going out and focus really targeting the neighborhoods on both sides of the river. So historic Anacostia and Farallon and Ward 8 and the Navy Yard and Capitol Hill and Ward 6. And it was the – I think typically the public engagement process is someone brings a sort of fully finished design to the community and says, what do you think? And at this point, they only have a binary choice of like yes or no, right? And this was a very different process where it was – should we do this in the first place? Was there support for it? Because keep in mind, the first 2 years, I was volunteering, right? So I wasn't getting paid. It was going out nights and weekends while working at the building museum, 50 hours a week. And if everyone came back and said, this sounds good, but we have other priorities, then this wouldn't have been viable.
Because if we had beers right now, we could drink every time the song
sparked. And this would be an awesome podcast near the end. Right, I'll be hammered. But that's not what we heard. We heard real enthusiasm for that. And I should say who we were speaking to. We went to 200 meetings those first 2 years.
What's the anti-bridge argument? I mean, it's hard to say like I'm against a park that you know is going to be beautiful and it's going to be this sort of first of its kind in the world and probably a destination kind of place. But who are the people that are saying, like, you know, don't do this?
I think it's a sort of 1-2 punch of the, first of all, there's an, particularly east of the river, there's an enormous trust deficit, right? Because people have come in and made promises and haven't kept those promises, right?
Yeah. So why should we spend our time knocking on doors or whatever?
Is this real? Are you really going to do this, right? And part of that, the main thrust of that is building trust with the community, and trust is shared experiences over time. So that's showing up again and again, even when you're not on the agenda, right? So I think that's one thing. I think the second thing is the question that I've been asking sort of more and more as I visit other cities is who is this investment for, right? Is this going to be investment be for me, for residents who live there, or is this going to be there for somebody else? And then
like a tourist or
wealthier people that are going to come and displace me, right? I mean, it's the whole
then
larger
build
question.
Condos,
and rents
the
are going to go up, and you're going to get issues of gentrification and displacement, right? Which is something that we can talk about a little bit because we've been spending, as you know, a lot of time and effort about that. So I think those are the two main.
Well, I know you guys
reasons.
Are sort of stitching together the main drag there, and then Anacostia kind of making that a natural extension of the path you're going to use to get across the river and then ideally up into the community, right?
That's one thing we're doing, but we actually spent a year and a half focused on how do we ensure that the thousands of people, tens of thousands of people that have helped shape this project from the beginning be the ones that benefit from it. So, and this is another thing that I had no idea that we'd be working on when I started on this 4 years ago, but we spent a year and a half coming up with working with stakeholders to come up with 19 recommendations and housing recommendations, affordable housing, workforce development, and small business enterprises that we just announced a few months ago at the end of last year that now we're implementing. So we're now running a home buyers club, right? With Mana Housing. Where we're funding it. So we're transitioning existing renters into homeowners that are focused on Ward 8. We are looking at providing down payment assistance of funds that we've raised for existing renters, for a new project that Man is working on in our Bridge Park area. To transition those renters into homeowners. We're working with City First Homes to explore a community land trust, right? This is so much more than a park. Working on workforce development programs, how do we encourage a broader constellation of small business
enterprises? And you don't have any official capacity. Like, you can't dictate anything. You're relying on all of the stakeholders voluntarily coming together around these various efforts. I mean, it's not like you're a city councilman. You can dedicate funds to
it. We don't own any property.
Department of Planning. You don't, yeah.
We're a convener. Yeah.
Wow.
So and I think that's really important for the, we call it, it's our equitable development plan. Is that we're not necessarily doing all of these things ourselves, but we're partnering with people that are experts. Like, we're not running a home buyers club. Mana Housing has been doing this for decades, right? But they've never led a home buyers club east of the river. So we raised money to pay for their staff and the supplies and everything else that they need to run one of these east of the river. And this is something I think that we're getting a lot of attention on with larger foundations around the country, is how do you invest in places of need without displacing the same people that you're trying to help? Right, sort of a simple thing to ask, really hard thing to do, but and we're working from the beginning, working with these stakeholders to help figure out what that might be. And at the end of the day, the last thing is that if we end up, we're going to build a big, beautiful park, and that's great. But if we build a community muscle that can shape the development around their neighborhoods, that can be even a bigger legacy than this park itself.
Mm-hmm. And you guys are set up as a 501c3.
We are a 501c3. Yep.
But you're housed within a community organization that's existed.
We had a choice at the beginning of either forming our own 501c3 from scratch or aligning ourselves with an existing nonprofit, and we chose the latter. So building Bridges Across the River at the Arc has been there for celebrated its 10th anniversary. And I approached them 3 years ago. It's known in the neighborhood as the Arc, and that's what I know them as. But when I learned that they're doing business as was building bridges across the river, I was like, all right, so this is like a not too subtle sign that this is, the skies opened up and
building tunnels across the river is a problem.
And I came in and talked to the executive director and their development director, and they saw that this project aligned with their mission to improve the lives of kids and families east of the river. We started talking, built trust, I brought in some grants, and I joined their staff about 2.5 years ago.
Wow. And so what are some lessons you learned in terms of just starting an organization from scratch? Brian was saying that was kind of one of the more impressive things, that is, you know, just walking in with a blank slate and having to build all of this infrastructure, putting together a staff, you know, a website.
Yeah, who did you lean on for guidance and recommendations? You talk about, you know, the idea of having to battle the perception of this might increase gentrification, right? You're going to build a bridge, and you said, you know, what community is it benefiting? And you've chosen to face that head on, which is the right thing to do, right? That's the holistic approach. But did that come naturally, or were you working closely with the ARC staff? Who were you leaning on for guidance?
I had a lot of contacts in the planning and development world from working at the Building Museum, which is helpful. The ARC was critical because the ARC, since it had been there for 10 years and is this sort of beloved cultural institution, really embedded in the community, they helped identify, okay, here's your 3-4 dozen leaders in the community that you need to go really early on. And I think that was a big lesson.
They made introductions for you.
They made introductions.
And gave you credibility to come with their backing.
That made an email introduction or a phone call and said, okay, Scott, you need to take it from here, I helped identify who those folks were. I mean, I could have figured out who half those were, but maybe not the other half, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then gave that credibility, right? Going to those leaders really early and saying, again, not, hey, here's what we're going to do, don't you want to get on board, but going to them and saying, really asking what they thought, right? And really asking them to help shape the project from the beginning was enormous, right? And again, that the building trust with a community of showing up at the I'm out in a community meetings, as you said, 3 or 4 times a week, as well as my staff. And you see people come in, show up at the one community meeting, and you never see them again, right?
I go, I volunteer, I show up for the first day, and then I probably you know.
You're on the email list for everyone.
Yeah.
So there's two parts of that. It's the presenters and then the community, right? But the presenters coming in and showing up once and checking the box and never coming back again, right? So showing up to these meetings again and again and again and building that trust, building those personal relationships was a critical sort of first step. And I'd love to say that there was a larger plan for this, but some of this was sort of figuring out as we go.
When he was mentioning, you know, who do you look to for support, I was thinking more along those lines, which is like moral support. Like, I don't even, you know, the task is just so daunting. If you sat there one day and said like, oh, I've got to raise what, $50 million? How much is it?
$45 million,
and this is going to take me 5 to 10 years, and I've got to do all these things. I would just be like, I'm not getting out of bed. I'm just going to keep my day job. Like, what? How did you keep going? How did you make that leap into like, I'm dedicating, you know, my days to this?
I think part of this was, I mean, so if I volunteered for this for two and a half years. Part of this is sort of breaking these up into different tasks, right? And how do you eat the elephant like one bite at a time, right? But part of it too was what gave us the confidence was, I mean, about 2.5 years ago, we launched $1 million pre-capital campaign to raise funds to launch a nationwide design competition.
And that was sort of a trial of like, can we get this?
Can we raise $1 million, right? And then that $1 million was based on sort of what our needs were, but it was also a nice round number, right? And we raised it. I mean, we raised it. It was hard. I mean, it took a lot of conversations with people. I now understand what that we hear business the owners talk about the first million sort of being the hardest, and I never really understood what that meant, but now I totally get it, right? Because funders had to believe in this really ambitious idea and that we could fulfill it, right? And we needed those initial angel investors who believed in the project.
But personally, why did you get up every day and decide to do this? Like, what got you out of bed? It's Wednesday and it's raining and your wife's mad because you're not going to be home for dinner and you're going
to
have
another community meeting. I think it's, I mean, from a So working, I think it's two things. Working in museums, particularly at the Building Museum, we got to bring in these amazing sort of folks talking about the projects that they created, right? But it was often presenting on those, not necessarily getting your hands dirty and doing your work itself. And so that I think was really exhilarating. And I think
just seeing examples of things other people have done, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. But it would often be, I mean, working at the Building Museum, it's fabulous. It was wonderful. But again, we were presenting about other people's work. We weren't necessarily doing that work ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. So we were bringing in Josh and Robbie from the High Line to talk about their work, or bringing people in from the Atlanta Beltline. But we weren't necessarily doing that work ourselves, really sort of hard work. Having that sort of ownership, I think, was incredibly empowering. And then two, it's being out in the community actually keeps me going, right? When you're out there in the community and you're seeing the stakeholders get as excited about this as I am, that has a tremendous amount of energy that's infectious and contagious.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose once you're starting to make those commitments, then your name gets associated with it, and it's your reputation and it's your livelihood now that you're actually a full-time employee there. So
it's a
kind of the buck stops with you, and if you don't show up, then
it's a serious responsibility. I mean, it's something we think about every single day. Of the
you ever feel like your hands are chained, like you wish you could just go work at McDonald's and relax for a couple nights?
No, because how many times could you have in your life? You can build something like this, right? Working with a community. So
I guess one, you get one really good chance.
Right, and sort of this is it. And
don't fuck this up. This is your one chance to leave a legacy.
I think and I do want to sort of pull back from that because I don't I wouldn't want to give the impression that this is like Scott's Bridge or that this is because there really isn't ego behind this. I think this is much more like at the end of the day, when we build this big, beautiful bridge and everyone is claiming credit for it, that is going to make me the happiest, right? Because that means that everyone has ownership over this project and has helped shape it from the beginning. And it's not sort of Scott driving this, it's the community driving this. And that's really critical.
Absolutely. But, you know, to be fair, or to just give you credit where credit is due. I mean, if you weren't here, this wouldn't be happening. And not that you're doing all the work or even most of the work. Or, you know, there's a lot of people who give a lot of money, and there's a lot of people who are working full-time on this as well. But, you know, that it was that first year or two of, like, when there was no money and there was nobody behind you, and you were out there, you know, hitting the streets. That's something that I think takes a level of commitment which few people have. I guess I was trying to figure out, you know, what is it that motivates? Because a lot of people say, "Hey, I'm going to start a company," or "Hey, I'm going to, you know, build a house." But then to actually follow through, it's those first, you know, few months or the first part of that endeavor when things are hard and the end goal seems so far away. So I just want to say it's pretty impressive. Any advice for me to do anything significant with my life?
Well, how about start a successful company? Oh, wait, Jack, you've done that. Right?
Wow, so successful. I don't know. What were you going to say, Brian?
But I think just on that, I think that anybody who started their own business knows that exact same thing, right? Things are different scale, right? You have an idea that you believe in it, and you don't know if it's going to succeed, but you're going to test it out and sort of see. But you need that commitment. I mean, you need that sort of this is going to be your priority, right? So,
but we don't want to beat this to the ground, but. A large part of, let's say, starting a company is going to be for, you know, maybe more selfish motivations. I want to make a lot of money. I want to buy a big house. Whereas, you know, there doesn't seem to be that sort of tangible return on this investment of your time.
I'm not doing this to be rich. That's for sure. I don't know. Yeah.
Part of what I'm hearing is something that as I develop myself as a sales professional, it's a mindset that is referred to as being detached, a detached state of mind. Doesn't mean that you don't have ownership, doesn't mean that you're not committed, but detachment is having the courage to ask, should we be doing this when you're already doing it full time? That's what you ask when you're detached. And the same thing for business or any sales situation. You know, you would ask the client, well, you know, what you've told me doesn't really make sense. Should we still be doing this project together? Because everything you've told me, you know, is different from the assumptions we started with. But what happens is when you're detached is you build trust because you have real conversations and you're in an active listening mode. And everything I'm hearing is really hard for nonprofits to do usually is to have that detachment because you're a mission-driven organization. But not every campaign you launch, not every outreach effort you have is going to be successful. And you have to be okay with that. But for a lot of people, especially younger in their careers, they might be thinking of this as, you know, some seminal mark on their resume, or this is going to lead them to that big job or that big paycheck or that big promotion. But I think you were able to come in with the confidence and the support where you could have that level of detachment and commitment at the same time. That really uniquely positioned you to partner with the community that, you know, like having said, maybe someone else would have picked it up, but would they have had the right state of mind, the right positioning in their life to approach these different communities and actually, you know, not to be punny, but to build that bridge? That's not easy. That's not easy. A lot of people fail at that.
Well, and I think it's would this have been more expedient, not easier, but expedient, to not engage the community and charge ahead? Sure, and that actually happens all the time. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the only way this is going to be successful is through that sort of deep community.
But there wasn't
engagement.
A big champion in the city government or the mayor's office or anything. I mean, besides the Department of Planning, there wasn't anybody who. Like the federal Department of Transportation, let's say, who maybe could have just built a bridge park had they felt like it. I mean, there was no official champion for this. So this almost, I mean, that becomes kind of your default route is to generate the grassroots support.
And build more champions, right. Mm-hmm. And that's, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was Harriet and me, and then we would build, and one of our key goals, and it continues to be, is how do you build those stakeholders? Our language internally is how do you build those champions, right? How do you build that larger sort of army of people who feel not just this is neat, but feel that there is equal ownership over this process, that they are going to fight just as hard as we are to make sure that this happens and it becomes realized.
And has this you describe some of this as organic, like, you know, just working with Mana, for example. You probably didn't plan on doing that 2 years ago, and nor could you have foreseen something like that. But when you sat down originally, was there a real, like, sort of strategic approach that you mapped out with Harriet or with other people in terms of, okay, you know, this is the methodology and here is kind of step one and step two?
It was, and I mean, we had one goal that first 2 years, which was just community engagement, and didn't want to intentionally didn't build out a larger plan after that, because it very well could have, because I think to your point, if we would have started mapping that whole thing out, it then would have had a life of its own, of like, well, we need to be on step three now. We could have gone through 2 years and or a year, 6 months, and have everyone said that there's just, this isn't viable, right?
So how did you measure community engagement? How do you define that?
I mean, I think that there's a couple different ways. One is numbers, right, is sort of the easiest thing to do that's probably not as important, but the having 200 meetings with in those first 2 years.
I've seen that in your literature.
We're up to near 700 meetings at this point, sort of with community engagement. But I think this is harder to measure, but it's sort of measuring sort of that enthusiasm, right? We're out there, and this also is a community that has not really been listened to for a long time. So, I mean, I got yelled at, right, for things that had nothing to do with the Bridge Park, but it was just people that were really frustrated that they hadn't had an opportunity.
The last person who talked to them like this said some stuff and didn't follow through,
Right, and who are you? And but I think once these larger stakeholders saw that not only were we taking that sort of community-driven design approach, but then we also asked them to say, well, what can we put on this? Help us design this space, right? I mean, that was the sort of next big question that we asked. And then they saw at the next meeting they went to me list a bunch of design ideas, and one of them was the idea that they shared at the previous meeting. It was like, whoa, okay, they're really listening to me, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a larger test. Like, this trust is, keep coming back to this trust thing, but this trust is an incredibly fragile thing, right? And it takes nurturing and caring, and also means, and I think this can be really challenging for a lot of nonprofits, but it means letting go of your power, right? If I had this idea that the bridge needed to have a rock wall down to the water because that's really cool, it's the community is going to drive this, right? And letting go of that can be really frightening. It can be really scary. It can be really chaotic, but that's the
so
surest
when,
way
when
to build
you got
trust.
Your designs in, did you literally not have or voice? You didn't vocalize maybe what your favorite was? Like, you let the process play
out? I did not
out?
Get a vote in the jury.
Really?
Yeah, and the talk about frightening. Like, that's just like, oh, crap, I'm going to raise millions of dollars for this. Like, no, I mean, the community stakeholders had a vote. The informal jury had a vote. 1,100 people who filled in an online survey from the Washington Post had a vote. I did not get a vote.
Wow. So what other things did you, if you could turn back the clock and start over again, you know, if you felt like now that you know the process better, and I'm thinking of this in terms of other people who may want to, now we have a dog that wants to escape and he's clawing. What other advice would you have for someone who's starting a nonprofit with some ambitious goals like this?
I think the thinking really early, and probably earlier than we did, on what the infrastructure is that can help support that, meaning website, email capture, we were doing, you know.
Just like tools.
Tools that you're, yeah. But thinking about those really early to set that up so that you could have, I mean, we now have, I don't know, 7,000 names and emails, and which is pretty good over the last few years, but
is that your lunch?
Dog is, yeah, trying to eat the lunch. It's going to be a tasty burrito. But setting up that infrastructure, I think, even earlier, would have been helpful. We didn't have the financial resources to do that, so that wasn't really that wasn't practical. But setting up those sort of mechanisms and channels even earlier than we did, I think, would have been helpful.
And what about community partners? I mean, you mentioned Mana. China, and you mentioned the importance of establishing those relationships, but you're having a river festival soon, I think, that may involve some partners.
We are. We're the – thank you. That's a great segue having.
See how seamless that was?
That was just – it was beautiful. It was. It was like watching – it was like listening to a symphony. We are hosting the second annual Anacostia River Festival coming up on April 17th. And just like last year, there's over 25 different community partners that are bringing programming to the table. And I think that's an important thing for us, is that we don't have to be the experts on everything. We can partner with the nonprofits who are the experts. And from a practical standpoint, the last year and again this year, it is an incredibly successful way to leverage we're multiplying the number of people that we can reach by 25 to 30 different times, right? Mm-hmm. Because we might have, 2,100 followers on Twitter. Anacostia Watershed Society might have 4,000, and Earth Conservation Corps might have another 5,000, and suddenly those really add up, right? But it's being really strategic and making it
Why have an event versus just partner with these groups because they have an interest in developing the waterfront down there? Or not developing it. I'm saying the River Festival doesn't necessarily, to me, have any relationship to the bridge, or maybe it does.
That's good feedback to hear. We should be more crystal clear about that. I think for us, actually, it's tremendously helpful. It's tremendously helpful in seeing how people get down there, right? And so for us, it's a way to sort of test transportation mechanisms, things that people wouldn't even think about, right? But like, is it hard to get down there? Will people come down there in the first place? I mean, we took this first festival last year on a little bit of a leap of faith. I mean, we had confidence it would work, but we had 6,000 people show up, right? Mm-hmm. Down to the river, which is great. For us, it's a great way to test out programming down on the site too, to see what's successful and what's not. So we built a 80-foot floating dock in the river, right where the future bridge park dock will be for kayaks and canoes. And again, I'd rather learn from that now before we start pouring concrete and evaluate it, test, pilot, and evaluate sort of those kind of interventions. Give people a taste of what's to come, but then also to see what we can learn from it as we go through some of the deeper design phases.
And how are you engaging with some of your partners over this? They're obviously sharing and marketing this to their communities, but are they providing any of the programming? Are they?
They're providing most of the programming. So and it's wonderful for them because it provides an opportunity to engage with 5, 6, maybe this year 8, 10,000 people. And for us, they bring that sort of human capital that we couldn't do by ourselves. And I think that's. This is a little bit of a jump, but that's the very same model that we plan. The bridge park, they will be managed. That each of the different programming areas on the bridge park, the Environmental Education Center, Performance Space, Urban Agriculture, would be run by different nonprofits. So it's a great way to sort of test out those relationships too and see who the partners are that we want to play with.
And are you organizing the festival and sort of around the same mix that the early designs for the bridge are in terms of what you just mentioned there?
Yeah, very much. So a huge focus is environmental education, given that this is an event that celebrates the river and its history and its ecology and the communities that live and work along both sides, but it's also a huge cultural opportunity too. So we're curating for the first time. We've brought on Washington Performing Arts to curate our main stage. So they've created a whole suite full of 9, 10, 11 different acts that are going to be playing throughout the day that represent both sides of the river. So we're kicking off the day with the U.S. Navy Band. I don't know why that's so cool, but I just think that is so cool. They actually said that, we could end our performance with Anchors Away. Would you want that? And I was like, oh, it's so cool. To having a go-go symphony band the play, to having a Frederick Douglass reenactor sort of WPA brings their expertise to the table that we might not necessarily have because that's what they do, is curate these main stages to present to the larger audience that's there. Mm-hmm. So it hits sort of multiple goals. And I think for us, the last thing is that we selected a design, but we're three and a half years away from opening this. So it provides a highly visible role that people will see, oh, the 11th Street Bridge Park is coming, right? I think often what happens is people run these big design competitions and then disappear for 3 years as they raise money and they start building this.
Suddenly the cranes get put up and they raise
and
like,
people,
wait,
what happened, right? Or I think more dangerously, the public asks, whatever happened to dot, 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 right? This provides a highly visible way to address that. And I think, again, by partnerships, I mean, we're partnering with the National Park Service, right? So this is presented by the Bridge Park and the Park Service. And we're also partnering with the National Cherry Blossom Festival. This is the official closing program of the National Cherry Blossom Festival. So in a marketing perspective, they put their full marketing weight behind it, which
is so they're printing
huge.
Out a gazillion flyers, and your name is on there.
And in every press release, some were mentioned at the big, where they hand the pink envelope and say when the and there actually is a giant pink envelope of when the peak cherry blossom, the blossoms will be. They mention, and this is one of the key 8-9 sort of programs. So
what are the right now? What's the schedule for the bridge?
We will begin our pre-construction hopefully this month or early next month.
What does that
mean?
What's pre-construction?
Pre-construction is permitting, right-of-way, continued work with the community and our design team to refine the designs of the park. We should begin that within the next 2 to 4 weeks, which is huge. This is a really big deal. We anticipate about a year and a half of pre-construction that takes the designs to 15%, 30% of design all the way through construction drawings, begin construction in 2017, and then the earliest we can open up would be 2019.
And at that point, the bridge is going to be run by you? Are you going to be standing on the toll booth collecting fares from people going across?
So the space will be free, which would be great. So I don't have to do that. But yeah, the idea would be that the building bridges across the river at the Arc would manage the space with these other nonprofit partners who'd be programming the different programming areas on the space. So, and that would, yeah.
And at that point, you'll spend some more time with your wife?
And the wife and the dog and the family and friends.
How has that been? How's the home life been because of this?
Is how understanding? This interview just took a turn to the left.
It's an intervention, Scott.
I know. She put you up to this? So I have a very patient and understanding wife, who is delightful and wonderful. She's a journalist, so she works sort of crazy hours as well. So and understands sort of what this opportunity is and has been extraordinarily supportive over the last 4 years, which is good.
How do you keep that momentum? Like, I mean, this project continues to scale. Your time doesn't. So, how are you prioritizing your day? There's a million things you could be doing right now. What does that process look like for you right now?
It's helpful to have more staff. So for a long time, it was a royal we. It was meaning me, right? But now we have a full staff of three. And then we're part of this larger nonprofit that does all of the back of house HR and finance and stuff, which is great. But still, there's what I've learned in life is that the scarcest resource out there is time, right?
You a much better manager now after this process than you were before?
I think so. I'd like to think so. You can get more dollars, you can get more staff, but you can't get any more time, right? I work a lot, but still, there's only so many hours in your day. So being really, there are bright, shiny things and partnerships that sort of come up all the time that we're having to do a better job of saying no to because it doesn't fit within a larger strategic plan. And that's hard to do because you want to build those partnerships and you want to bring people in. But as we sort of remind ourselves, if we don't build the bridge, all of this is for naught, right? All of those programming has been great and wonderful, but we need to keep our eye on the prize, which is raising enough money and going through the construction process to actually build this thing.
And I know you're from California, and I think if memory serves me, your wife got a job out here and you moved out here, and it wasn't necessarily going to be forever. It was for an opportunity that maybe a couple of years and then moved back to L.A. And now you've really integrated yourself in the community here. You think, is there a different, you feel like you're more of a resident of the district or of your neighborhood now than you were before? And
Yeah, about so my wife and I gave ourselves 5 years when we came here. Like, oh, let's see what happens. That was 10 years ago. And it was three or four years after moving to DC. I was in LA visiting friends and family, and I was flying back and making chit chat with somebody sitting on the plane next to me. And someone said, "So where's home?" And without thinking about it, I said DC. And I sort of stopped and said, "Wow, that was weird." Because it was the first time I'd sort of said that with just as an instinctual response. But DC is home. And we love DC, and it's fantastic. So yeah, we're here.
Great, Brian. You want to ask the question? It's been so long, you forgot what the question is.
Talking about our sponsor.
Your favorite? No, we'll...
No.
I love the question.
We,
it's such import.
You know, it is the question. We got to come up with like a couple of questions. It's a good question though. We like to pause for a minute and ask any of our guests if there's a nonprofit they'd like to give a shout out to. That's not their own, because that's always the easy one. So is there anybody, small, big, local, national, that you'd like to give a pitch for?
Yes. I mean,
you asked
us
earlier, said, is there anything I could think about that I could prepare for? And we said, no.
Yeah, no,
you have to think
me.
About it on the spot.
So I'm not going to choose a DC nonprofit because there's just too many, and that would mean there's too many that I'm leaving out.
They're all here.
A nonprofit that I've been very impressed with is the Atlanta Beltline. So it's a 32-mile sort of railroad tracks that they're turning into this big greenway around Atlanta, and the much bigger scale, right? This is a multi-billion-dollar sort of project. So but they thought really early about this larger displacement issue. How do we make it work for the local residents? And they created this equitable development plan that we've really learned from a tremendous great deal. And so I think that's been extraordinarily helpful. And I'm going to say one other that is local. A nonprofit who's been so critically important to help us think through this is LISC DC. So it's a community development corporation that's here. And they devoted half of a full-time staff to just project manage this equitable development work. Without that, we wouldn't be at the point where we are. All the props in the world go out to LISC DC. They've continued to be really strong partners with us, thinking about these issues of investment, displacement, and gentrification.
I'm going to have to look up that Beltway project. That sounds pretty...
Yeah, I think incredible. I think I videotaped. It's probably... There's a video that Foresight did on the National Building Museum website talking about that.
Wow. It's amazing. I haven't been down there, but we've sent my staff down there to see it, and it's phenomenal.
What were you doing in Sao Paulo, by the way?
I was vacationing.
Oh, you were. It wasn't official.
It was not official. Oh, although okay. I'm always sort of have my Bridge Park hat on, of looking at sort of designs and but yeah, that was all vacation with my brother.
So, okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, great. Thanks so much for stopping by. We'll put the links up to your nonprofits when we post this.
Yeah, and if somebody wants to find you or Bridge Park, how would they do that?
They can just go to the website at bridgepark.org, and all of our contact information is on there on how to contact us. And
yeah, are you looking for volunteers? Are you looking for money? Are you looking for what? What kind of help can people give?
There's several different ways that people can get engaged. Thank you for that prompt. We're looking for volunteers right now for a river festival on April 17th, which is great. We're going to have several hundred people.
That means we're going to have to get this out before April 17th.
nothing like a deadline to focus one's mind, right? People can make a contribution. We're a 501c3, so it's tax deductible. And three, and this is one of the ways that we've had to build more champions for the project. We've asked people to start hosting these things called friendraisers. So they invite their friends or coworkers or whoever into their home or local bar or cafe. We come in and show a little presentation and lead a larger discussion about the Bridge Park. So these are small, like 20, 30, 40 people at the most. But it's been a fantastic way to help build more champions for the project and increase the awareness.
Fantastic.
That's awesome. Thanks, Scott.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.